And we have two items of interest left.
The letters.
URM letter and the Better Housing by Design letter, and that's the one that needs to be approved today.
You need to leave at 7:20, just so you know. That's an hour, so hopefully that's fine.
I believe Kirk is leaving even before that.
Okay.
I got
permission to stay.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
From the higher ups here. So the next item, well, I guess we'll take a 2 minute, I guess we could take a 2 minute break. Is updating the historic resource inventory. And we have Brendan Spartansauer-Hartle here to lead the presentation.
Before Brendan goes, I think that I should go ahead and say on the record that this report, I was part of the consultant team who put this together for the city. And I'm saying we being me from my office, and then there was another architecture office who collaborated on this. But altogether, we handed this off to the city for some refinements and also, you know, for the city to kind of put it together in its graphic form. And so I am no longer involved, you know, in any changes in this document. It kind of, you know, exists as a moment in time, I guess, for our office. But I think it's okay if I talk about it as a commissioner today. You know, especially if I can sort of answer any questions that might come up or anything like that. But I also want to be cognizant that if my fellow commissioners have criticisms and comments on it, I really hope that you don't feel constrained at all of bringing those up. You know, I think the city has worked on this as well, and you know, we're just all trying to make this a better document. So please don't hold back on my account.
Well, I think with that, I'll go ahead and get started. Brendan Spartansauer-Hartle, Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. Apologize for the little technical glitch there. My USB drive said it was not a file, so I had to run up and grab my laptop to make it a file. What I want to do is do a quick briefing on the report that I think you all have a copy of, the updating the historic resource inventory print report. I think you each got one of those in your packets, and we've now put that on the BPS website. And just sort of walk through what we have been doing relative to the historic resource inventory, why we commissioned this report, and what the report authors are telling us, and then where we're going forward, given the recommendations that the report authors have provided, as well as sort of the internal thinking of BPS staff. So by way of quick background, in 2016, 2017, City Council provided a one-time budget allocation to BPS to invest in an update to the historic resource inventory. That one-time money showed up in our bank account a little late in the fiscal year. So we were left with sort of a, I don't want to call it difficult, but we were left with the charge that to spend the money, we would need to do a direct contract with a minority women-owned or emerging small business to be able to meet our deadline for when the dollars had to be spent. We direct contracted with Convergence Architecture, who subbed out some of the work to Peter Meijer Architect, which is what Kristen mentioned earlier in her sort of sub role on the project. And the report was intended to provide direction primarily to Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, but also to City Council, this commission, and sort of a interested public about what the historic resource inventory is, but primarily how internally how we can get us to a place where we have an updated and modernized historic resource inventory. So the intent was really looking at providing recommendations to staff, to interested people about how we get from inaction to action, updating the inventory in the months and years ahead. And I should say, too, given the tight kind of constraints on spending the money and the timeline, but the majority of the work for this report was completed over about a 4-month or maybe even a 3-month period at the end of the last fiscal year. So it was a sort of a May, June, and then spilling over into July effort. Staff did make a number of changes to the report after it was submitted to us by the consultant team. And we held off on publishing the report while we made a number of additional changes to it and sort of worked within our limited budget to do sort of a real simple graphic design layout, et cetera, et cetera. But also just given sort of the, let's call it the holiday distractions, chose in the fall to wait to release the report until now-ish. And I'll explain why in a little bit, in a little more detail in a minute, given some of our current funding asks of the City Council. So just as quick, really quick background on the historic resource inventory, I know many of you have been on the commission long enough that you've asked City Council 1, 2, 3, 7 times for an update to the inventory. But for those of you who are newer to the commission, I thought I'd give a quick background. The historic resource inventory was conducted in the early 1980s. At the time, the inventory was done as sort of the first comprehensive look at the city's historic resources, and as a vehicle to meet, at the time, statewide land use planning goal 5, which in the 1980s did obligate cities to survey and inventory historic resources. That's no longer the case. We don't have an obligation under goal 5, but at the time we did, and Portland set out over the course of 4 years to take a look citywide at historic resources of sort of myriad areas of significance and architectural styles, periods of significance, in sort of a intentional and comprehensive way, relying on city staff, hired consultants, and neighborhood committees to bring forward the sort of list of notable and significant historic resources that told the story of the city. So in 1984, when the Landmarks Commission adopted the inventory, 5,000 resources were added to it. 3,600 of those resources were ranked. So a ranked resource was one that had demonstrable historic significance and was eligible for designation as a landmark or as a contributing property in a possible future district. And then the sort of resulting 1,400 or so were notable, but maybe not eminently eligible for designation. So of the unranked properties, there are a lot of sort of oldest house in the neighborhood or interesting building from the recent past. Not really sure if it's significant enough for designation, but worth noting anyway. A number of sites where buildings once stood that are no longer in existence. And then a variety of other resources that had some cultural or architectural value, but may not be candidates for landmarking. So those 5,000 properties, as I mentioned, were adopted by the Landmarks Commission in 1984. I think it's important to note that the City Council never took action on the inventory, that it was adopted by this body, but never adopted by City Council, and that there has not been an addition to the historic resource inventory since. And I have an asterisk there for the next slide to say, in the years since the inventory was adopted in 1984, there have been more than 33 surveys or survey-like reports that have been completed. These are things like the Downtown Modern Building Survey, some selective East Portland Residential Modern Surveys, survey reports that were conducted for TriMet Light Rail Lines or ODOT projects, things like the Portland Public Schools Survey that was done a few years back by one of your fellow commissioners, proposed historic districts that may not have been listed, and then other sort of thematic or geographic surveys that provide a wealth of information, but that never made it onto the city's official historic resource inventory. While those surveys still provide good and useful information, while they met an expectation at the time, for all intents and purposes, they're sort of on the shelf, as it were. So an interested public would have to know to go search out that survey document to identify whether or not a property in their neighborhood or in an area that they're concerned about had been documented, that wouldn't show up on our citywide inventory. In addition to that, though, we have seen dozens, probably hundreds of individual landmark nominations citywide, as well as the formation of most of our historic districts. So in 1984, we had a small handful of historic districts. Now we have 17. And all of that designation activity has happened sort of in parallel with the inventory. So designated resources are not entered onto the inventory per se, but there are significant historic resources. We protect those resources. They're documented. That information is publicly available. But the inventory and our designated building lists have sort of lived side by side, and I'll talk about that in a minute. In 1995, the legislature passed the owner consent law for historic designation and subsequently revised Goal 5 of the Land Use Planning Program to move cities away from a requirement to inventory to an encouragement to inventory. In 1996, the city of Portland interpreted that to mean owner consent was required to add a property to the inventory, and that owners had the right to remove themselves from the inventory if they so chose. So for the last 22 years, the city's been operating under the belief that the inventory is a type of historic resource determination that warrants owner consent, and that owners can refuse to continue to live on the inventory. And our thinking on that has changed and is changing, and I'll talk about that in the next slide. So recently, in the last 2 years, there have been several sort of more meaningful policy changes that give us an opening for the first time since the mid-1990s to engage in a process to add properties to the inventory. First, in 2016, the state Supreme Court ruled on the Carman House case, clarifying the circumstances where owner consent was required for a historic designation, making the determination that subsequent owners did not have the right to remove a designation that had been imposed on their property, that owners had to demonstrate at the time of designation their opposition to designation, and lastly, that there was a group of properties that were under consideration for designation that need not have owner consent, and if an owner refused designation, there would be a demolition delay period before they could get that demolition permit. That Carman House case informed the Goal 5 administrative rule update from last year, and those new administrative rules clarified the procedure for adding properties to a historic resource inventory and determining which properties on that inventory are significant. But probably most important, the state administrative rules now say that owner consent is only required for designation. It's not required for an inventory. And that was sort of the big sort of legislative hurdle that the city has been hung up on for the last 20 some years, believing that the inventory required owner consent, now operating under the knowledge that state administrative rules do not require owners to consent to mere listing in an inventory. So sort of in the same time period, the new administrative rules are being developed. And after the Carman House case was decided, the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability brought forward a code change to require a 4-month demolition delay process for properties that were ranked on the historic resource inventory and proposed either for demolition or removal from the inventory. We brought that code change forward before the new administrative rules were developed to tell us that we don't have to honor owner requests to be removed from the inventory any longer. We still have that in our code, but we don't have to do that under state law. So that sort of brings, I think quickly, that brings us up to speed to where we are today. And so I want to give a quick sense of what BPS has worked on over the last 6 to 8 months as the consultants were drafting their recommendation report and sort of in the context of the changes in sort of the state landscape. First, we've brought on now our third intern to help us with quality control review of all existing historic resource inventory records. So when we, about a year ago, actually I should say a year ago, we had a out-of-date and inaccurate Excel file of all of our HRI resources. Today, we now have a pretty high level of confidence in the digitized information around our HRI resources. We've scanned all the HRI forms from 1984. We have photo JPEGs from all that 1984 work that are assigned to the records. We've linked all of our historic resource records to the SHPO's Oregon Historic Sites database so that they can speak to one another. We have, and I've mentioned this a few times before, we have a web map now where all of the resources are either HRI or designated resources. All of those resources are available for sort of understanding or the public information online now for all the historic resources, and it links through to the SHPO's Historic Sites database. We launched the Historic Resource Code project in the fall, in part to help us get a better sense of the procedure for adding properties to the inventory. And then last, we used that one-time city council money to commission the report on how we move forward an inventory update. So just as a quick overview of what the consultants told us in the HRI report, they provided some background on what, you know, sort of what and how the 1984 inventory was conducted. They outlined what they believe to be the deficiencies in the data and the sort of comprehensiveness of the 1984 inventory records today, identified five sort of primary reasons to update the inventory, and then gave the city 14 recommendations sort of in a step-by-step guide for how they would advise we move forward with planning for and implementing an update to the inventory. And here are those 14 recommendations. I think they're on page 17 of the report, I think, or that's not right. Page 21 of the report kind of provides this table of 14 recommendations. We're doing part of number one today. Number 14 is some distant time in the future where we've done pilot survey work. We've done our first additions to the inventory. We've sort of brought all of our data up to a modernized and defensible database of information that's publicly available, and we're sort of in a period of ongoing survey and inventory work. So it gives us a spectrum of what the Planning Bureau and what City Council should be thinking about in a lead up to a sort of major citywide inventory update, and gets into sort of a deeper level of specificity about how we might phase step by step an inventory update. We are hoping that we can, if we are successful in securing the funding requests we have out in the universe right now, we think we can get through the 13th recommendation in about a year from this spring. So if we are aggressive and fare well in City Council's budget, most of or all of the recommendations through the 13th one are something that we can look forward to doing in the next year and some change. So I want to highlight a few of the sort of recommendations and what we're doing to advance them. First off, we have a new intern who's here today, Sabrina Ferry, who's going to help us continue to refine and digitize our existing records. Second, our tech services team is scoping the development of a functional database and mapping application that will take us from that web map that I've shared a few times to a platform that allows you to sort, filter, categorize, and better engage with historic resource records. We've been, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute, but we've sort of worked ourselves into their schedule for an app, sort of mapping app development in the spring and summer. We have the Historic Resources Code project, which will be a necessary change in the zoning code for us to add properties to the inventory. We applied for, and I heard on the phone yesterday, that we've received our $12,500 once every 2 year CLG grant, which is not a ton of money, but we did ask for the money for working on the HRI. We didn't specify parameters around what we would survey. We didn't give them a geographic location or a resource type. We just said we want to put it towards survey and inventory work. We have an $80,000 budget request for City Council's consideration to bring on a HRI administrator and to conduct pilot surveys. And then we know we need to develop forms, procedures, standards, trainings, get out in the field and survey and resurvey resources. But we know those recommendations are contingent on us receiving City Council funding to go and do the work. We don't have the existing staff capacity to pull all that together, nor would we feel confident being able to do it in alignment with sort of federal best, national best practices, and be able to engage volunteers or engage consultant teams in a meaningful way unless we had that additional staff capacity and dollars for surveying. And so those are sort of the main things on our mind from the report they're working on. I want to dig down into two of them specifically. One is the idea of a expanded database and mapping application. We think we've already gotten further with our historic resource web map than our consultant team was thinking we might in their sort of first engagement with the project. We've put all our resources on the map. We've got all the baseline information about those resources. While we don't have a public portal for sorting and filtering information, we internally can. So if Kristen calls me one day and says, I'd really like to know which fire stations in Portland were built between 1902 and 1915, anything that's on the inventory or designated that we know is a fire station or is associated with that resource type, we could pull that information. But the thought is we want to be able to have a resource that professionals and academic users can sort and filter resources sort of in their own home. So Hillary or me or anybody could say, I want to know buildings built by John Bennis in the 1920s citywide, and it'll pull up the list of those things. Or I want to know which resources have been tagged with association to women's history, be able to pull those resources up. So as we're working with our tech services team, we're working with all of the existing data from our inventory and local landmark nominations, everything that SHPO has about resources, and looking to expand it with tagged citations, fields for additional data, the ability to sort of cross-reference between records, and potentially to take public submissions for a historic photo someone finds on a property, or additional details on the property so we can consider it the next batch of inventory updates. So thinking about something that's useful for both the general public and for an academic or professional user, and able to allow us to receive information from a broader public for future inclusion in inventory updates. If all goes well, we expect that sort of database and mapping application to be released in late 2018. So shooting for fall, late summer, fall sometime, that we could have a sort of a better version of the map out there. And we have been looking at, well, I should say our report authors looked at Denver, Austin, and Los Angeles. We've been looking at a broader range of cities for how they're doing their database and mapping applications. And as our thinking has evolved, as technology has evolved, we think we can sort of take what New York and Kansas and Los Angeles and these other cities are doing and sort of build it into something that's equally, if not more, user-friendly and valuable. And then in the Historic Resource Code project, there were a few sort of big questions that we need to answer, and we're not going to answer those here tonight. We can talk about them a bit in our discussion after a couple more slides here, but you know, we've got some big questions about sort of what to call historic resource inventory resources. There has been sort of confusion in the public about how could a resource be on the inventory but not protected, or conflating landmark status and inventory status, or being unsure how something could be on the inventory, or should I say, how could something be designated but not in the inventory? So there's some sort of code questions that relate to sort of nomenclature and classifications. And I'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute that we'll need to work through in the code update so that we're being as accurate as possible with our descriptions of these different designations and determinations. We need to be thinking a little bit about how the HRI and other designated resources fall within the same bucket. And I'll show you kind of what I mean about that in a second. And then probably most importantly, we need to develop the land use procedure necessary to add surveyed resources to the inventory. So in 1984, this commission accepted 5,000 properties onto the inventory with a hearing. We believe that the new Goal 5 rules require us to engage in a land use process to add properties to the inventory. Staff would not have the administrative power to add new resources to the inventory. There would need to be sort of a public notice and a decision made anytime we add a group of properties to the HRI. And so we need to really develop out that process so that it's legally defensible and so that it doesn't get conflated with a designation that, that requires owner consent. And then sort of last in my short list, staff will be proposing eliminating the owner opt-out provision. So today, owners on the inventory can say, I want off. We say you've got to wait 120 days. At the end of 120 days, they come off of the inventory. That allowance over the last 22 years has effectively left our inventory being a voluntary list. So it's not as pure and objective as it was intended to be in 1984 and has left us in a position where owner rights really are trumping the public value of understanding what resources are significant to the built environment. So those are things in the code project we're going to have to think through, you know, related to the bigger effort to get our inventory gears in motion. I want to explain just briefly what I meant about sort of the naming conventions and the classifications. This is a property in the Kenton Conservation District. It's individually listed on the National Register of Historic Places. It's a local landmark. It's a local conservation landmark. It exists in a conservation district, and it's ranked on the inventory. And so what today sort of our, the way our code functions is that this property is each of those things. And so it doesn't provide necessarily the clarity for a member of the public or someone out there to understand what this resource, what significance is or what sort of classification it has. And you see on the map, it's not as clear as I was hoping it would be, but there are multiple different points and shapes and all these things that each have their own sets of records. So each of those determinations have a different set of documentation behind them. And as we update the zoning code and develop our map and database application, we want to and probably need to collapse records together. So this property would be all of those things still, but it would be conveyed in a clearer way. And I don't know that this is exactly what we're going to do, but you know, thinking a little bit about one concept or one idea that's on the table, not necessarily spelled out in the report, but something on our mind is, you know, we've got sort of a barrel or a bucket of historic resource types that are documented, that are publicly available through our mapping application. Some of those are significant. Some of those are designated. Some of them have been surveyed, but maybe not determined significant. And so not necessarily tonight, but I'll take comments tonight, but we're gonna, staff will be working with you as we work through the code project to determine what the right, how we may make some refinements to the language we use to be precise and predictable in what we mean when something is surveyed and added to the inventory, but is not determined significant, and how we might use language to sort of better define how resources that are surveyed multiple times or maybe been surveyed multiple times and designated, sort of how we describe that resource in our database and mapping application. I know it's a pretty technical thing, but my brain is trying to work through how we do that and not end up with resources that have 10 different classifications because of, you know, sort of the history of their designations and inclusion on inventories. I should also say, too, the report authors are recommending we move away from the ranked and unranked classifications for inventory properties. It's based on sort of SHPO best practice. And also, over time, the differentiation between a rank one, rank two, and rank three resource has become less clear. So in 1984, rank one resources were intended to be eminently eligible as landmarks. Rank two resources were significant, maybe eligible as landmarks. Rank three resources could contribute to a potential future district. But now, 34 years later, many, if not most of the ranked resources, whether they're rank three, one, or two, are probably eligible for landmark designation or conservation landmark designation. So that ranking convention, while I think it worked well in 1984, we're being advised not just by the consultant team, but even just internally, that might not be the direction we want to continue. So that's a future conversation for another day, but the ranked and unranked really, I think, in 1984 boiled down to not determined significant enough for designation, yes, determined significant enough for designation, maybe as a landmark, maybe as part of a district. And so I want to engage in a little bit of discussion here in a moment, but our next steps in where we're going with inventory is would love to get some of your comments tonight. Mostly we just wanted to bring the commission up to speed with what we've been doing, provide the report to you for sort of as you have time to take a look at it, to provide me feedback, to prepare for some tough discussions in the Historic Resource Code project. Staff are going to continue to reconcile, refine, and digitize existing records. One of our sort of intents over the last 6 to 8 months has been to ensure that we've managed all the stuff from 1984 and our existing records related to designated resources, manage those as well as we can so that we can demonstrate to council, to grant funders, to the broader public that we at the city can manage what it is we've already have for historic resource records before we go out and start to add new ones. Staff will continue to scope a new database and mapping application. So if commissioners have suggestions or functions they'd like to see that database and map offer, we have been looking at other cities and what they've done. We've been incorporating everything that CHPO does into our thinking. But if there are specific things that you would like to see in a database and map tonight and in the months ahead, we'd like to hear that. Staff will continue to work through the Historic Resource Code Project code concepts to get us closer to a place where the zoning code is the vehicle by which we can add properties to the inventory. And then in the spring, City Council will vote on our budget request. At present, the mayor is requesting that bureaus propose reductions in their budget. This is a one-time add package. And so it will fall into the sort of the big pot of City Council decisions about what to do in an era of sort of tough prioritization of where resources go, whether or not the inventory is something that council wants to continue to fund, or I should say something they want to invest in this year. And so after sort of those next steps happen, it'll give us a better sense as to whether or not, A, we'll have the resources to move forward with any inventory work in the coming year, year and a half. And then B, if we have the resources coming to the commission and asking you, where best should we start on the ground survey work? Should we start with St. John's and Montevilla? Should we start by resurveying 1984 records? Should we start with a thematic survey of a resource type to get your direction there? So we're not... I guess I should say, unless and until we receive the funding, we're not in a position to make those decisions. We did suggest to City Council in our budget ask that we would prioritize underrepresented historic resource types, but we were pretty vague in what that might look like. We do have about a fifth or a quarter of the city's geography, which is not represented at all on the inventory, and so meeting that threshold is a pretty easy one for us to do. I do have a couple more slides that we'll talk about after some discussion about where we're at with the Historic Resource Code project and the multiple property documentation, just because I thought that might be of interest to the commission tonight since I'm up here, and Chair Ranzetta did ask me to come and talk just briefly about where we're at with some previous work that we've been doing around documenting African-American historic resources. But since I just gave you a whole bunch of stuff, what I want to do is stop there and engage in discussion with the commission about initial thoughts you have if you've taken a look at the report, and then just sort of engage in a larger discussion here, knowing that it's almost 7 and I'm happy to stay as long as you want, but I don't want to lose commissioners before we have some time to talk about stuff.
Okay. All right. I've got... My main concern with survey, no matter what survey you're doing, is like, what is the goal of survey? Because the data that's collected in your database should be matched up with what your ultimate management goal is. And you know, in some jurisdictions, your survey data will be incredibly detailed. One example is in Alexandria, Virginia. They have, you know, a survey program that asks you what type of, you know, muntins are actually in the windows. Are they single divided light? Are they, you know, or are they genuine? What type of window material they are? Because their level of management is much more significant, is significantly higher than it is here, at least from a management perspective. And also the other thing is that most of the resources are right in your face because the building basically goes up to, you know, the street practically. So you can see everything. It's right there in front of you. And I remember when I was first doing survey for, I think, Irvington, or even maybe before that, there was a lot of concern about using kind of the SHPO survey, reconnaissance level survey in particular, as the mechanism for listing a district. And the concern was once it gets turned over to the planners for them to manage the resources, there's not very much information in there that can really help for you to understand what, you know, what exactly are these people doing to the building. You're going to have to ask people to supply a lot of information about their windows, about their exterior building materials, just to kind of fill in some of the gaps that the survey is not necessarily giving you. Because, I mean, the SHPO RLS survey is pretty basic. And so that was the question I had, I think, for this is, you know, at the end of the day, big picture here, what is kind of the management goal? Is it just to figure out what's important, what's not, and kind of defer that decision on the specifics later when people actually designate stuff, or you know, what exactly were we going for?
Well, I think it's a really good question, especially in the context of our owner consent for designation law. And so, you know, on one hand, I think you want the inventory here to have enough information to provide the public and the property owner with something. And I think our report authors struggled a bit with the minimum RLS standards, maybe not quite giving us enough to really demonstrate whether a building is significant or whether it would be a good candidate for individual designation. But then on the other hand, knowing that, you know, we've got something like 200,000 tax lots in the city of Portland, maybe even a little bit more than that. And so over time, as we look at resources, there's a lot out there, and so we'll have to be efficient with our time. And so sort of in our thinking, if we determine a resource to be significant or ranked, as we currently call it, that we want to have enough evidence and enough understanding of the resource to be able to make that call. So one small thing that sort of the report authors recommend is, at a minimum, if we're considering something as a significant resource, we should have a very short narrative description. I mean, it could even be a few sentences about why that resource stands above and beyond others to be considered significant. And I think that's something that the 1984 inventory failed to communicate was why did one resource get ranked and another did not? There's a nice scoring rubric on the back that means nothing to anyone. But what it didn't do is didn't say this Queen Anne in Woodlawn is significant because it's got the horseshoe balcony and it's got the original siding and it's of a period of time that fit within this context and it really does stand out as a resource eligible for landmark listing. And I think, you know, in the years since the 84 work was done, looking at a form and being able to make that determination on your own is tough. And so, I guess the long-winded way of saying it, I think having any information in the inventory about, or let's say minimum RLS information in the inventory about resources could be an incredibly helpful asset for research and for understanding themes of resources, types of resources, filtering their stand. But I do expect that we need to go beyond that if we're saying that something's significant. So what that looks like, I think we'll need to suss out as we get into sort of City of Portland minimum expectations. It's probably not an ILS, you know, a SHPO ILS level documentation, but it's something in between. And I think that the report authors gave us a few recommendations on what that might be, but I think we're going to need to go a little further and say, if you want to be considered significant, you've got to do these things. But I think it's going to be a really valuable question, especially knowing that the we don't have unlimited money to do this. We don't have unlimited staff time and support to be out there in the field doing surveys. So how do we balance?
Yeah, and I think one of the ways to strike that balance is to really take advantage of those previous surveys of the 33 is probably too minimal. There's probably a lot more that are out there you just don't know about that I don't know about. I mean, for the Rose Quarter project alone, there were, I think, three different surveys that are not in the SHPO records and not in the city records that were performed there for various federal projects over time. In addition to the Cornerstones project, you also had the Albina multiple property documentation form that was prepared and had an architectural survey that accompanied it. And where that architectural survey is, you probably have the record somewhere, but it's not necessarily, you know, out there generally for folks to just tap on the internet and find. You really have to kind of dig around to find a lot of this information. And the more that information you can kind of bring in, even that just background information, can help you have a better starting place. So when you go out in the field, you can actually compare what you're seeing. Because the Cornerstones project, I think, is probably one of the most important projects that are out there, because there are a lot of resources associated with African Americans in particular that you would never know just from looking at the street. I mean, there's, you know, a dental office, for instance, that was funded by the Black Panthers. And, you know, you look at the building, it's a dental office, you know, right now. It's not, you know, it's a 60s building, and you just never know that what's that was going on there. And just so there's a lot of that. That's the stuff that kind of scares me doing a survey, because on the reconnaissance level survey, we picked it out, luckily, just because it had integrity. And then when we dug into it, then that's where we found that. And so I guess the reconnaissance level survey is a good way to start at a very baseline level. And I appreciated seeing that in here, but I'd like to just make sure that we try to capture as much of the data that's out there as possible and load it into the database when you decide on what to use.
Well, and what's nice about that too is there's some that's low hanging fruit, right? So we're going back and doing some quick resurveying, or we wouldn't be starting from zero with those records. Some of those, like the Albina survey from 1989, I think. Many of those resources are gone or altered or whatever, but it gives us a good starting point. And I do think a lot, the one survey I think about the most is your PPS survey from 2009 or 2007. Mm-hmm. Because we regularly hear from school groups, like a teacher at a school or a class that's doing a project, or a high school student who says, like, I'm researching this stuff and I found your map. And I think how unfortunate it is that our schools are not in the city's database and map of historic resources, that we aren't even providing the information to those people who maybe are best users of the information about the schools that they go to, that we've got it, that work was done, but it doesn't show up as a historic resource on our map. So we have to say, well, you got to go find the study that was done in 2009, download the PDF and all this stuff, where that information really belongs in our inventory. And I think taking a look, going back and taking a look at the work that's already done, and bringing that in big batches is going to be sort of critically important.
I was just wondering, I know the survey late people came and presented to you guys at some point. That was a survey that was just did a massive survey. I mean, and I know that they also identified a lot of sort of important features about buildings that aren't tangible, sort of the Jewish community, for example. I'm just wondering, do you guys, do you have access to that material? I mean, it might be helpful, because that was, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of properties, and they just finished it. So I don't know if you guys looked at that, or if that's something that, I mean, it's like Getty funded it. So it's not like a proprietary, I don't know. It's sort of a background.
We did look at, just maybe speak for Kristen here really quick. We did look at LA as one of our three example cities. And so we've got sort of in the back.
I saw that, yeah.
You know, a comparison chart. I think one thing that's on my mind, that's a lesson from 1984 that I'm choosing to hear, and I don't know if others feel the same, is that we did this big sort of one and done survey effort. We spent 4 years out there in the field. We're gonna look at the whole city. We got grant dollars and general fund dollars and volunteers, and we did it with the intent of going back and doing additional surveys. But the sort of after it was adopted, the staff left, the consultants left, the thing kind of dried up. And I think something on my mind, just kind of looking at the availability of resources here, and then also thinking about sort of the iterative nature of survey inventory, better understandings of resources. I think one thing that I think may be different between us and LA is I think we want to build a culture where we're continually updating and managing the inventory, and that we don't run into the situation we had when I came on board, which was no one had been managing the existing records in years or a decade or longer, and nor had we been adding things to it. And so part of our thinking is we really do need the staff, sort of the staff intention around this is a living thing. We're going to continue to refine our records, build upon them. When a resource is demolished or altered, we're going to reflect that on the map. When new information about social history is discovered, we're going to, you know, modify a record, or we're going to incorporate that into our next batch of inventory updates, or, you know, that kind of long-term management that I'm not sure how LA is handling going forward.
I don't know. That's a good question. And I totally see where you're coming from, and that makes a lot of sense. I guess I meant specifically just the extent of what you're serving, what information initially goes in there, like sure. What are the fields that you're filling out, for example. Are you looking at the window configuration, whether it's historic or not? So I was just thinking, how do these massive surveys, what do they look for? What are the, you know, what's on their tablet that they fill out?
I wonder if, like, I was thinking, sorry.
No.
Even if, like, sometimes it's more important to know what you don't know rather than what you know, and then especially going forward, like, are there drawings available? There may be questions, fields for that survey that may be totally extensive and maybe seem irrelevant at the time, but if we know we don't know that, then it helps us understand what to look for later when there is more money to redo it.
Or it could be uploaded over the years if it's a living survey. Right? Those fields can be added later or not at that time.
Yeah, and what's significant now or may not be significant now could be significant down the road, potentially. We don't know what's going to happen at that property. And I also wanted to just put in a pitch for including information about URM and whether it's known to have a retrofit or not, so that some of that information can get more integrated and available kind of immediately.
I think that's just really to respond to the URM piece. One of the things that's on our list for what we'd like in a database and sort of to reflect on the map is information from Bureau of Development Services that will populate into a field that may say, maybe there's a URM field for, is it a URM? Has it been upgraded? Or maybe it's a field for relevant land use reviews. So the commission approves of alteration to a landmark building, you go to the record for that building, it's populated in from BDS to say this building had a land use review last year for alteration to the, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I think that's exactly the kind of functionality we'd like to see.
There's also, especially with Cascadia, you know, maybe there's a field that's, do we have the level of information we need to satisfy FEMA? You know, I don't know what that would be, or if there's sort of a defined list, if that's a black and white thing or not. But just looking at, you know, this discussion about resiliency, and again, I'm going to get on a soapbox here, but you talk about assessment teams going out. I'm involved with another group that's trying to get the state to recognize architects and engineers as post-disaster and building inspectors who have been certified. But state law doesn't allow that. So anybody that's going to be used as post-disaster inspection is a building official. They could be a mechanical engineer. You know, they're not necessarily like a structural or architectural specialist. So I'm really concerned that, you know, there's like 200 people, you know, we have 500 people that are certified in the state to do this, and they can't be used by.
Who opined that that architects can't? I mean, it's the one, I'm sorry, I know, Brandon, you've been talking for 48 minutes, but the one thing that struck me is what you said in the very beginning, not straight through. I mean, we've been talking to you, but I will say that the one thing I've been thinking about the whole time that we've been having this discussion is the fact that for 22 years, somebody misinterpreted the law, and it caused somebody to have to bring a case all the way to the Oregon Supreme Court to have that law reinterpreted. And I can't help but wonder, why am I, no offense to the present company, but why am I here? Why shouldn't I just be out there trying to bring these cases to find out what is and isn't legal, rather than, and maybe I could save more buildings that way than sitting here reviewing individual land use cases. I don't know.
You can do both.
My question to Commissioner Mahoney is, who told you? I mean, what? How do we know that that's true?
We've been in contact with Building Codes Division, who originally had ownership of this list that went after 2008. They didn't have funding to keep on top of. So we've got an ORS and specific language that states this.
Okay. Well, that,
so, and we're getting
the city attorney apparently misinterpreted the ORS as to the owner consent law, right, for 22 years. So I would just be very clear as to what that ORS actually says.
Yeah.
I mean, it just makes me so upset. How many buildings did we lose in 22 years? Like, I mean, how many were removed?
Yeah, and so it's a question of whether or not we would have lost them anyway, since the inventory wasn't a designation. I wasn't able to protect them with anything more than delay. But in the last 22 years, through demolition or requests by the owner to remove the resource, well over 100, 200 maybe. Oh, and many have been designated. So of the 5,000, there's a significant number that are now a landmark or now in a district. But, you know, even in the time I've been here in the last 2 years, it's something like 40 or 50. You know, it's a lot. And they may have been lost anyway, since mm-hmm. they weren't designated and protected. But for the past year, we've had that 120-day requirement. You know, owners can still come off. I want off. We give them that right, and so that's something that the code project will seek to change.
Will you be able to go back and look at properties that still exist that were removed to
I think so. Them? I think they'll. Because they were removed under the zoning code at the time, we would probably need to propose to bring them back in as part of an inventory update. Like, I don't know that we could do that administratively,
no,
but it's a question that we need to.
You can't just, no. I mean, if the code at the time said that it allowed them to take it off, then you can't just retroactively plop them back on.
But there's no reason we couldn't prioritize it or add those to the list
of
priorities
I agree.
To look at.
They could be resurveyed and added that way.
Mm-hmm.
I've brought this up before, and I just want to bring it up again as part of this whole process that, you know, we're always talking about the people who want off or who want to object. We should have an avenue for the people who want to get on to say, I consent, because everyone that consents today, we don't have to worry about it anymore. So I really feel like we should be sending every person on the list a letter that says, hey, you're historic, we think, or however you want to phrase it, to not be a designation, but to pass along this word that with your consent, you can be this forever. Anyway, it just seems like there's half the people who probably say, I'd love to consent, just like sign a covenant that says, I consent. And I'm just throwing that out there because you're talking about, I like the collection management approach, sort of the way a museum would manage its collection. You're looking at it on a regular basis, you're evaluating condition changes, you know, environmental concerns, all that stuff, you know, managing it. But until you get those people to consent, your list is not a management tool. You can't do anything with it until you get them to consent. So,
and I think too, Matthew, to that point, as we develop out sort of the Historic Resource Code Project landmark and conservation landmark designations and make those more enticing or more viable. It may well be that many of our HRI property owners could be approached about, do you want to become a landmark or do you want to become a conservation landmark? And sort of what additional documentation we needed to bring them into that, but that's something that certainly would be a good question. I think the other piece too is, I think there are a number of people, myself in the past included, who question the value of the inventory as something that is not a protection tool. And so this gets back to Kirk's comment a minute ago. I think many people are looking for relief from change or demolition, and the inventory is probably not that tool. The inventory is a sort of a necessary part of understanding the built environment and a tool that may open up doors for designation or protection. But the inventory is a tool to understand, celebrate, appreciate, capture the built environment in a way that can be used for preservation purposes or planning purposes or property owners, you know, sort of research and documentation. But I think one thing I'll ask the commission to help staff with is advocating for inventory updates, but also recognizing that it's not the silver bullet for stopping neighborhood change. And that's, I think, going to be a tough conversation for a community that's really focused on change and really focused on the sort of on the ground demolition and new construction issues.
But I think it's actually what you're describing is exactly what we've been saying, which is that historic preservation and development or change or density are not incompatible. So I think it's actually better to say, look, the reason we want to take an inventory or reconnaissance anyway at the is to find out what we have. You don't know what you don't know. And, you know, what we decide to do with that information, you know, in the future might be something different. And that way, you know, neither the people who are arguing that we shouldn't be either assessing or reviewing these matters, and the other, because we're overreaching in the time of an affordable housing crisis, nor can the people on the other side, right, the people who actually want to use it to prevent demolition, neither would those arguments prevail. So I think that the way to message it is simply that we're doing this because we have to, you know, we used to have a legal mandate to do it. We changed our Goal 5 rules. We no longer have a legal mandate to do it, but, you know, it's still in the Goal 5 and also the comprehensive plan to preserve our historic resources. And we, in order to do that, we have to know where they are or what they are, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of the first blush, first
right
step.
Right. And I think there's a important kind of public policy element to this, and I think it comes out in the report, is that when you do survey, you're almost like an ambassador for historic preservation, because you're sending people out into the community to talk to people, essentially, because you're going to get stopped when you're doing survey, and you know, if you're choosing to wear a fluorescent, you know, shirt just so that you're seen, usually people will come out to you and ask you what you're doing. And I think that that's an important touchstone. And I also think that those folks need to be armed with kind of the message as to why it's a good idea. And I think that's where the challenge becomes, is that really the only thing we've got for them, aside from the special assessment, which is only open to some of the properties and the federal tax credit, is what are the benefits for historic preservation? And they have to be a little bit more than kind of the normal lip service that we provide. And I think that's, you know, we can't forget about that piece. And the other piece is also, you know, the first blush survey is good. It can tell you how many, you know, Queen Anne style houses and buildings you have. But I think it's really the personal narrative. We, you know, every once in a while, you do need to do a little bit of a deep dive just to make it a little bit more personal for the neighborhoods involved, because it helps people kind of understand a little bit more of that kind of tangible presence of the past and helps them to kind of relate to those stories in a way that's kind of outside of the public policy debates. Because I think everyone can kind of share and celebrate that history outside of that. And I think that that's, so it's like we want everything coming out of something that we don't have a lot of money for up front. But at the same time, you can't forget those little pieces. And if there's a way to, you know, if there's something, you know, you can get laser focused on in addition to doing kind of a broader based survey, I think it's important to keep that in mind.
I'm right with you on some of that, because I think that the inventory and the sort of map and the database has the potential, and kind of have this appear as a public and academic user, but the potential for a broad public to access, let's say the 30-second elevator pitch on buildings in town that are important, and that with the technology we have today, there's no reason why the inventory can't serve both as our sort of city plaque program, you know, like here's the historic photo and the quick, you know, what it is and the interesting sort of here's what makes this property unique or interesting or different, and then all that other stuff that we as professionals rely on to sort of the academic or the intellectual understanding of the resource. So sort of in this mock-up of what we, one idea of what it may look like for a public user, the really quick stuff for the, you know, it's a Queen Anne and it had this person who lived there and their story is really unique because this.
And so I think Kirk had asked if you would, when you're filling in this data, you would include some of those 33 surveys that have been done, so that would there be like a link to those? Like, would, for instance, if this Hollywood theater were on one of those surveys, would it say somewhere on here as part of the...
bring that data into there.
Oh.
I think is what they're suggesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Coalesce all that data into this.
That'd be helpful.
Yeah, I mean, URS has been doing survey in Portland for a very long time, and we've got all those records just kind of sitting there. They're all mostly public, and none of it ends up in SHPO's hands because they've been throwing that information away.
And we think things so, like tags, you know, sort of tagging, sort of different contexts, right? Like if your resource has African-American history and... it's significant for community events or whatever, and starting to sort of organize those tags and assign resources to different context statements that they're already developed, you know, like East Side properties, you know, multifamily residential, whatever, Ellis Lawrence design building. So to sort of connect resources to the context statements that already exist or that will exist in the future that tell the contextual story behind the resource. We think there's a lot of opportunity with sort of our current technology to tell that story. So you click on the record and say, Hollywood Theater, it's cool, but it's also associated with these broader stories.
That'd be great. Cool. I wish you had this done like a year ago when I started throwing myself into the Oregon Historical Society records looking for information about my house.
Well, it's not too late for us to take those.
I want to echo Commissioner Mahoney's comments just briefly that maybe the URM survey would be a great start because there's some dovetailing with some other 10-year phasings of seismic, and those, I don't know, potentially could be at greater risk due to some other policy changes. In terms of the...
And I've got some emails from Deirdre McCarthy. She's the chief of... GIS at the Park Service, and they're developing some survey tools, and it always seems like they're doing this after a disaster. That's when all the money gets cleared, as opposed to the pre-disaster planning when it should really be done. But they're asking the same questions about elevations, for instance, in Florida. What can they do to kind of minimize impacts in the future for hurricanes? So there's no reason why we shouldn't be doing that now. And that's a question really for FEMA. And I don't know if in the current political environment that's even possible, whether the pre-disaster planning funding will ever be returned to what it should be. But nonetheless, we should be kind of plugging away, asking for it as often as possible. And I've got a little thing here about, one of the things that they're working on in Florida and Maryland and Vermont right now with and I think your project may be just too far along, but it's something to think about in terms of they have a customized version of Collector. And they're trying to just gear it for each state, and each jurisdiction can. And I mean, you guys have been saying the same stuff. Everyone's kind of got their own little version of that going on and trying to kind of idiosyncratically gear it towards their own community, but it's something to think about as well, because they did a pilot program in Alexandria, Virginia, and now they're just kind of starting to spread it around a little bit. So
I'd love to see that. We have been using ArcGIS and ArcGIS Collector
Good.
To edit and modify resource information. That's probably it may well likely be the platform we license to consultants or internally, like I might use to edit or reconcile data. But what the public will see is like a different and maybe more usable interface. I mean, I think this, for those of you who have not used Collector, you know, you get, to our slide here, you get sort of a map that has points and shapes, and you know, it's really useful if you know how to use it for for the public who may go with something a little bit more visual or done in a little different way, maybe similar to the map apps that the Planning Bureau puts together for projects, where you can click a property that sort of zooms you in, then it's got a column on the side with information or photo galleries and that kind of stuff. But Collector works really, really well. But I'd love to see that,
okay,
that documentation. I think the one thing too, Kirk, you mentioned asking FEMA for money, and I think that we need to be exploring all kinds of sources if we want to be serious about this. But one thing for the commission to know is that the city council does have our budget ask for an ad package that they would consider in April at budget hearings. So if the commission feels strongly about this, making that known to the city council will probably be critical in us having a chance for the money.
I have a question. Something you mentioned about the 84 was never adopted by council. Is that a deficiency and created the situation we're in, or is that just a minor detail? Will they adopt the new one?
So how do we say it? We will likely ensure when they adopt the first batch of inventory updates that they also recognize the 84 inventory data as being part of the inventory. But at the time that the commission, the Landmarks Commission, adopted the inventory in 84, we believe that that was done defensively. So that this commission had the ability to do that, that it didn't need to go to city council. But it's on our mind, and it's maybe a I that we need to dot or a T we need to cross, but we're not, staff is not all that worried about it being a problem. It may very likely be, and it probably will be, that in the future, city council will be the body to adopt sort of the slate updates of the inventory. So whether it's once a year, once every 8 months, just-in-time delivery, likely this commission would make a recommendation to council, adopt, you know, or update the historic resource inventory by adopting these new 3,700 resources onto it, that kind of thing. But that's what we need to figure out in more detail in the code project. I'm going to take just two more seconds here. I'm going to be real fast about this. Just so everyone knows, as a quick update, we're way over time. I did want to say that we have completed our first four public roundtables on the Historic Resource Code project. We closed our online survey. We had between 40 and 60 people attend each of our roundtables. Survey was over 400 people took our online survey. We have over 200 unique code concepts that we've received through public sort of feedback and staff discussions. I will come back to you more with sort of our draft code concepts and details. But just as a real quick 30 seconds that I was going to be up here, we've sort of done our first round of broad public, tell us what you want to tell us. Let us know where you think there are challenges or opportunities so that we know that going into code concept drafting. We've done that. We heard from more people than we expected to. We heard more conflicting things that we expected to. And so we're in the process, both BDS and BPS, of sorting through those 200 plus concepts just to start to get a sense of what are we hearing. Kirk had asked me to give a real quick update on the African American Historic Resources Multiple Property Documentation Project. The SHPO is reviewing our refined draft of that sort of umbrella National Register nomination. We're awaiting their comments. We should receive those this week. and we're targeting the June State Advisory Committee on Historic Preservation hearing for consideration.
Great. Great. That's good news.
68 minutes now, Wendy, you've been listening to me. So unless there's any questions, I'm going to...
69.
I'm going to stop. But I would love from individuals, comments, suggestions on all things related to the inventory. Shoot me an email. Give me a call. And again, remembering that there are budget hearings in April that we are looking to at staff to see what council does. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Brandon.
And then before we go, I want to make sure at the very least that we get to the Better Housing by Design letter, and I have printed copies.